Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mully and Hanley, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score, Chicago's sports station.
I feel that chill, smell that fresh cut grass.
And then you look at Chicago.
I'm back in my helmet, cleats and shoulder pads. Standing in the huddle, listening to the call. Fans going crazy for the boys of fall.
Mullion Hanley, Chicago didn't Sports Radio, 6-7 of the Score. David Hahn knows a good story when he writes one. I got to tell you, David, it's been a lot of fun to read your coverage, but a lot of fun to watch this team, and it's kind of thrilling to see the underdog, if you will, the, I don't know, we're all underdogs, the less privileged, the team that's got all the odds against them, take advantage of a bad situation maybe and get themselves into the Final Four.
Morning, Molly. Thank you very much. Morning, Brian. You know, it's been one of the challenges this month is trying to figure out where does this rank in terms of how much fun I've had covering a team, because it keeps getting better. You know, it's a story that has you think has peaked, and then all of a sudden something changes and you're watching something else remarkable. And Saturday night was one of those moments, rare, and it was remarkable. And I think it's just because these guys are having so much fun together. It's somebody else every night. You know, Ben Richardson comes through on Saturday night, and it literally is the fourth straight game in the NCAA tournament and the fourth different player to emerge as the so-called hero. And everyone played well, but when you have a guy who has a career night on the most important game on the biggest stage of his life, you're like, oh my goodness, this is too good to be true. And there's that element to this. There's that feeling of, you know, it's too good to be true. And you know, Porter Moser, just the ideal coach for this moment for this team. You know, energy, enthusiasm, all the things you want in a college coach. And then Dante Ingram, last thing he does before he walks off the podium Saturday night, he says, and he says it sort of half in the microphone, half for people to remember, we're not done yet. And you think that's bold, and you think he has every right to be, and you think he might be right.
You know, David, the feel-good part, too. You do this long enough for a living, and you certainly have, and Mully and I have. Your BS detector is fine-tuned. Your phony meter is always at the ready. And it just does seem too good to be true. I mean, good things are happening to good people. And all the backstories that we're learning about, and you took us into the stands with Porter, the moment he shared with his wife and kids, and seeing the teammates, you know, sharing their moment as well. It's really, the basketball is great. I mean, if you're a basketball purist, you're loving every bit of the X's and O's parts of it and what they're running and everything else. But the whole package is what you're really thriving on, because it's just they're not missing anything that I can see.
I think you're exactly right there, Brian, and that's what it is. I mean, this is a cynicism-free zone, and you walk into that locker room, and it is there is a bit of a corniness to Porter Moser that's endearing, and there is a bit of an innocence to the best friend since high school or since third grade, winning championships in high school, and now playing together in college. There's a certain level of novelty that is fun, because look, with due respect, you're not having the same feeling when you're covering Kansas Duke, okay? Yesterday, there's a different feel and there's a different vibe, but those two teams have been through all this before. When you're covering Loyola on the verge of making the first Final Four since 1963, and watching the way they've done this, you're right, the basketball's terrific. They spread the floor, they share the ball, all those things. They play the heck out of a defense. But it's the way that they do it, and it's how they behave, and everything that they have done to come together to rise to the occasion. And it's trying to maintain that balance between, you know, dare I say, academics and athletics. It's the college sports model, as we've said. And it does sound redundant. And all of it sounds like we've said it before, because we have. But we keep saying it and repeating it because we can't believe it. And it is different than Duke or Kansas or North Carolina or Kentucky, because Loyola is on the verge of doing something that they haven't done in a long time. And we're just all, you know, benefiting from watching it.
Sports are, you know, a fairy tale factory, and that's one of the reasons that we get all these Disney movies that celebrate this, you know, big game at the end of them and all that. What's amazing to me is that we know that upsets are a big part of all sports, but some sports bring out more upsets than others, and certainly the NCAA tournament can do that, and certainly we saw that in Loyola's little corner of the bracket. It's just extraordinary. But they've already beaten a 3 seed. Now, you know, we're going to start figuring out 3 seeds. But for a number 11 seed to win 4 games, it's not just a fairy tale. It's so unlikely, so unusual. We have seen it happen, and it usually ends at this point. Do you, having watched Michigan, having seen the Ramblers, how do you rate that game? What do you think of the possibility?
I think that they're mirror images. I think they're very similar in their approach. They're both very well coached teams offensively. You know, you could put on tape of either team at different times throughout the season, throughout the tournament, and use those sets and the execution as a clinic, because they execute and they're efficient and they're smart with the basketball. I think the difference, obviously, is that Michigan has deeper, bigger, better athletes, and that's going to be a challenge. I mean, you're going to match up and have individual isolated mismatches. And there's going to be times where you're going to know that you're watching the difference between, you know, a Big Ten team and a Missouri Valley Conference team. There's no question about it. You've seen that in isolated moments against Tennessee, Miami, and Kansas State even on Saturday. Those were, you know, some athletic players. And defensively, you know, that you saw why Kansas State had their moments. Loyola is going to be really challenged, and I think it's going to be as difficult as tall of a mountain to climb as they've had. And yet, I wouldn't bet against them. I'm not sure yet that, you know, I think they have a shot. Yeah, absolutely, Molly. I don't know how, you know, logic has gone to the wind. And the only team that I think is very, very difficult to see losing next weekend is Villanova. And I think I've said that and maintained that, and I think throughout the entire tournament. They seem to be on a mission. They have everything together. But Saturdays, you know, I don't pay a ton of attention to what Vegas says, but I can't imagine this is anything. Is it going to be a pretty close game? And it's going to go down to the wire again, but I would not bet against the Ramblers.
Michigan by 6. And
really?
Michigan, yeah. In Michigan, of course, you know, they had a guy named Cassie Russell came out of Chicago. And,
yeah.
they beat the 1964 Ramblers, the defending champions, knocked out of the tournament.
I was in an elevator on Saturday with somebody who was at that game and was telling me it was after the game. It was funny, Molly, and you would love this as an alum, because the hotel was just mobbed after the game with celebratory people, and I'm in the elevator with this guy who was at the 64 Loyola Michigan game, correct? Tell me about Cassie Russell. Tell me about this. Tell me about that. And vowing that this is going to be the year that Michigan goes down.
Now, speaking of betting and challenges, you've written about it a couple times, including today. The challenge is going to be finding a way to pay Porter Moser. And, you know, Steve Watson, the AD, knows it. The university president knows it. And, you know, you get the sense that there's a ceiling that they have, and will that be enough? If you're wagering today, what do you think? Is he going to be here next year?
It's a great question, Brian, and I think, you know, that's why I wrote about it. I think it's one of the bigger questions of on minds of Loyola fans. You know, everyone's got an opinion, and mine is that he's going to stay. And mine is that, and he doesn't have any offers yet, and I think that I think Loyola can give him a raise. I think that he's $1 million-a-year coach when you look at the marketplace. I think that he deserves it. When you look at the type of program he's built and the publicity that this run has generated, you know, it's you look at the disparity in Final Four coaches. Jay Wright, I think, 2.5. You know, Bill Self's at $4 million. Beilein is, I think, a couple million dollars. You know, and Porter Moser's $420,000. There's going to have to be an adjustment to his salary. And I think that, you know, Steve Watson in the aftermath on Saturday night, I talked to him. He basically indicated they understand that. They've talked about that internally, if not with Moser, but they've talked about that with the president, Joanne Rooney, who told me the same thing before the tournament. The Board of Trustees chairman was there on Saturday night. They're consulting Mully for direction. Going to be reaching into his pockets. But look, seriously, I think that Porter Moser's quality of life is very high right now. He loves being the Catholic kid from Chicago who has led this team where he is. His wife and four kids, that matters to him. And I don't think it'd be the same being a big deal in Cincinnati, being a big deal at Xavier, and being a big deal at Rhode Island. I mean, yeah, they'd pay a lot more money, perhaps. But $1 million in Chicago would go a long way in your hometown. Also, Loyola was very loyal to Porter Moser. He talks all the time about the patience that they had with him through the losing early. You know, maybe it's time to reward some of that loyalty if they have a deal that is fair and equitable, and he feels like he's well compensated. There's more than money to this guy, and I really believe that.
Well, I'm going, David. I'm going to go to the game on Saturday.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah, I'm going to need you to
get
me.
I'm going to give you a notebook and a laptop and to put you on deadline.
I was going to say I'm going to need a press pass, apparently, because
okay.
The tickets look expensive. So I'll get my David Hall mask on and try to mug you in the elevator with that guy from 64. All right, buddy.
I'll meet you at the Riverwalk. That'd be fun.
All right, pal. We'll have a drink
right,
when you're done right. And take care. That's David Hall from the Chicago Tribune. He's doing a great job. It's fun to watch. And, you know, he's a sucker for a story like that.
Who isn't?
I mean, who isn't is right. But you get cynical if you cover
enough
sports.
I love what he said. Cynicism-free zone. That's
there
what
you
it
go.
Is.
It's fun to watch, and it's got a lot of good to it. We're going to take a quick a little moment, and we'll bring in Big Z. It's Big's time next on Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Red Biggs. Biggs time.
Biggs.
With Molly and Hanley.
Biggs time.
The Biggs Report.
With Brad Biggs.
Biggs time.
Big Z.
His name is Brad Biggs.
Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Hanley, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 of The Score. Brad Biggs is the football man of the Chicago Tribune. He is a longtime contributor to this program and a dear friend. Big Z!
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Well, you tell us. The owners' meetings reveal that the Bears are the favorite in the NFL?
I don't know that people are feeling that good about them, but certainly a lot of buzz for the Bears based off the activity that they've had mm-hmm. in free agency, based off the coaching change. And so I think a lot of people are looking at them as one of the interesting teams to keep an eye on moving toward the 2018 season. How quickly can they get their system in place? Will things come together right away for him? How will the quarterback play? What will the offense look like? So a lot of a lot of interest, I think, in what they're doing, and that's refreshing for the Chicago Bears, because I think for far too long they've been kind of a ho-hum team that people didn't pay a whole lot of attention to, didn't find particularly interesting, and that's changed for the better here, and hopefully come September it's going to lead to differences on the field for them.
Interesting to hear the different owners differing on what they should do about protests during the national anthem, and it doesn't sound like they're going to come up with a unified front or a unified rule or procedure. What was your take on that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of interesting that you've got completely different opinions on how that should be addressed from the very top, from the league, and that leads you to believe that there's a good chance they don't
they can't come to agreement, at least right away, on what is the best policy from the ownership standpoint. Now you're gonna have varying opinions on this, and certainly if they're wise about this, they'll try to work with the players to come up with something that they feel is going to work. You're not going to come up with a policy that makes everyone happy, in my opinion. But you've got to find a way to come up with a policy that somehow makes sense, and you can spell it out why you're going to do it that way to everyone, and see if they'll follow. You know, that's a touchy subject for some people, not every people, but the people that are passionate about that one, both ways, they're going to have a hard time seeing the other point of view. That's for darn sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think even within ownership, we're seeing differing points of views, and we're seeing that, you know, there's, and again, I blame Roger Goodell, Brad. I think that he needed to anticipate what was going on before last season, and by not doing anything, by not responding, by not figuring out a way of whatever it might be, even, you know, it was suggested just keep the players off the field during the national anthem and then bring them out, and it just changed the way that the league operated and whatever. I don't think they anticipated what was going to happen. They didn't anticipate that the president was going to get involved, and they didn't anticipate that there would be so many people believing that their ratings are connected to this.
Yeah, and I don't – are the ratings connected in possibly a minor way to this? Sure. Is it putting a big dent in the eyeballs that they're getting watching their product on the field on Sundays? I don't believe that. But, yeah, no, the league's been reactionary on this, and they certainly didn't see this coming. And so – It's going to be interesting to see if they can wrap their arms around this, and you would have thought that maybe they would have planned for this a little bit more coming into this meeting. Instead, you've got owners saying basically two completely different things. So a little bit of a hot topic for the league, and a topic that has nothing to do with the product on the field. So that's why they're struggling with it as much as they are.
What's the biggest thing that came about from these meetings in terms of the product on the field?
Well, when you talk about the product on the field, I think you're going to – the catch rule is what mm-hmm. is getting a lot of attention. And can they come up with something that does a little bit better job of passing the eye test? There is no – perfect solution to what's a catch and what's not a catch. Okay, it's going to be a subjective evaluation, no matter how your rule book is written. There's going to be human eyes watching it and saying, I think it was this or I think it was that. So you're going to have people watching a game pissed off with calls one way or the other, no matter what happens. But some of these plays that just sort of looked like they should be a catch and were not ruled a catch, and you can go all the way back to the Calvin Johnson play in the end zone at Soldier Field, jumping up over Zach Bowman to snare that ball is an example of something that looked like a touchdown. If they can clean that up a little bit, I think that would help their on-field product, no question. There's been talk about guys pass interference, changing that rule to simply a 15-yard penalty for pass interference unless the official deemed it to be, you know, just completely egregious. I don't think it doesn't sound like that'll get enough momentum to be passed, because you see some of those huge chunk penalties that happen from time to time.
And they're trying to get New York out of the catch rule and trying to, you know, eliminate reviews and interpretation. But why would New York have to enter the fray to eject a player I mean, can't the officials on the field know if a guy, you know, body slams somebody or throws a punch or whatever? Don't they just set a standard and tell their officials to enforce it?
Well, or if, unless you want to look at the review a couple times to make, you know, to me, if you're going to talk about ejecting somebody, you need to be certain. And so in the case of an ejection, I would think it would make sense to spend a little bit of time, hopefully not a lot of time, but a little bit of a time reviewing the infraction in question and to deem whether or not it's worthy of an ejection.
The league is considering a lot of different things. They've got, I think it's a total of 12 proposals and some other.
And they usually fail. You know,
right.
Different. You know, people, because the different. You know, any team can propose a rule change, and generally speaking, they don't get enough momentum to rewrite the rule books.
So you don't expect any of these things to really affect the game.
Well, there's not going to be wholesale change. I think we're going to see something happen with the process of the game.
Right.
That I could see, and the other stuff we'll have to see. I don't know if anything's hot enough yet to. And I'm talking about, you know, some of these ones that would, you know, they'll make changes to procedural stuff that really doesn't have anything to do with anything people pay attention to. But in terms of rules on the field, I don't know that there's enough momentum to get anything changed. You know, in the past, they've talked about wiping out the kickoff returns, guys.
Right, and
seems that's a conversation that doesn't seem ready to completely go away yet.
Some of these are about the replay rules and adding things like roughing the passer, hitting players in defensive position to things that can be reviewed. Do you like that, or do you worry about anything that slows down the game?
Yeah, I think if you add stuff like that, you've got to find a way to add it where you're not slowing down the game. Remember, recently, one of the real emphasis has been put on speeding up the game. Their games were taking too long. The NFL likes their game to fit in a nice, tidy 3-hour window. If the game kicks off at noon, they want the game over at 3, so tune on the 3 o'clock game. You can switch to that.
Right.
They don't want the product going 3 hours and 12 minutes, 3 hours and 15 minutes. So the more things you introduce to replay, potentially longer your game is going to be. So I think that's one of the things that they have to keep an eye on. You know, they changed the timing this past year of how they were doing things in terms of television timeouts after kickoffs and things like that. They were looking to, you know, shave just a little bit of time off the clock to keep the game fast-paced, which is what I think most viewers appreciate about the game.
All right, Biggsy, thank you, buddy. We appreciate it.
All right, guys.
That's our guy, Brad Biggs, at the owners' meetings and a lot of stuff to vote upon, and we'll get updates from Biggsy. And, Mark, we're going to bring in Bruce Levine next and ask him what happened with Victor Caratini over Chris Jimenez. How did that happen? How did he miss that one?
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Play ball!
Bruce Levine, 670 The Score baseball analyst.
It is all baseball.
32 years baseball veteran reporter.
Bruce, I've known you for a number of years now.
Breaking stories faster than a herd of speeding turtles.
I like turtles. All right, you're great zombie.
Twitter at MLB Bruce Levine.
By the way, I loved you in The Wizard of Oz.
Bruce Levine.
Mully and Hanley, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 to The Score. Bruce Levine joins us. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, gentlemen. Are you all ready for opening day? Because I think Joe Maddon's ready for his first lineup with Ian Happ being the leadoff man. He certainly earned it in spring training. If you can earn a job in spring training or a position in a batting order, I think Ian Happ has done that.
Happy is good.
You know, Bruce, I told you when I was in camp, I had heard that Victor Caratini was the guy over Chris Jimenez, and you told me that Caratini wouldn't play enough games and that it would be Jimenez.
Isn't it great to be wrong?
No, I'm just curious what changed.
No. What happened was they went up and back until the very end on this, and Joe talked about this Saturday that not everybody was in total agreement on which way to go. Because the case that I made, how Caratini is a valuable player in the organization and needs to catch every day because he doesn't have that much experience there, was one area. And then the other area that won out was he's improved so much and he gives Joe a switch-hitting weapon to catch when Contreras isn't in there or in late innings to go in and for Joe to be able to match up with Caratini against any type of reliever left or right. Those were the things that determined it. Also, the important factor was is that they have control of Jimenez's contract until June. He has an out clause in his contract that if he's not on Major League roster June 1st, he can ask for his release. Doesn't necessarily mean he will. But those are the considerations that they made to begin with here.
So how does that play out? Is there a loose plan on how much he gets in there, either actually catching games or pinch hitting, how many times a week you see him? And similar with Ian Happ, you know, you had the four dudes auditioning. He's not going to be out there each and every day, right? You're going to still see some other guys atop the lineup.
Well, you know Joe, right? I mean, you guys have watched him. Everybody's watched him for 3 years. Does he have a set lineup except for a few different areas? You know, I mean, we don't know for sure that Baez has won the job totally at second base. We assume he has, but, you know, you still have Zobrist there. The situation in the outfield is it's going to be a rotation of outfielders. We know that Schwarber's going to start in left, Happ's going to start in center, Hayward's going to start in right. Are they all going to stay there every day? I think, you know, production's going to determine it. Matchups, as we know Joe Maddon better than anyone else, is going to determine who Joe uses on a given day. So Ian Happ could hit like four home runs in the first seven games and still be on the bench for the next two if Joe likes to match up with Al Mora in center field instead.
Will Caratini catch anyone in particular? I mean, you look at Jimenez was going to catch you, Darvish. Is there a chance that that Contreras could play first base and you could have Caratini with him sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I don't think Jimenez was ever going to catch Yu Darvish. I think that was just a media-driven story from the beginning because of the fact that Jimenez had caught him in Texas and that they had a relationship. But I think Darvish said it straight in his first press conference that he likes Wilson Contreras. And that means that he likes the bat and he likes the arm and he likes everything that Contreras is these days. So I don't think anybody's going to have a designated catcher at this point. The only guy that will have a designated catcher that I can tell you for sure is going to be Contreras with John Lester. That's how it's going to match up. I don't think you'll see Caratini, except if there's an injury situation, catching John Lester because of the defensive protection that Contreras supplies him along with Rizzo at first in that little triangle defense that they put up there when people are on first base. So from that perspective, I don't think you're going to see that. But Caratini, you know, has shown that he can get a big hit. The organization believes he's going to hit a lot, and they have given them their stamp of approval on him starting the season.
Was there a lot of conversation when it came to Carson Fulmer getting the number five spot in the rotation? And you know, does he get a 2 month run here, a 3 month run here? No matter, you're just going to grow with him.
Dylan Covey, this year's Dylan Covey.
Well, I think you can answer that question by saying unless it's embarrassing, I think that he's going to get a full run to develop as a starting pitcher. And again, are the White Sox expected to win 95 games and win their division? No. So this is a player development, and it starts with the pitching staff, and Fulmer is a part of that audition from opening day that Giolito and Lopez are in as well. I mean, they have never, you know, you have nine guys with the Chicago White Sox that never started a season that are starting this year on the roster, never started a season with a major league team. So there's an awful lot of player development at the major league level for the White Sox this year, and those three in particular. Now, you asked me if there was a lot of questions on Fulmer. Sure. Up until these last couple starts here, he had a start against Milwaukee about a week and a half ago that was horrendous, and there were question marks. And if you notice, Hector Santiago is lined up exactly on the days that he pitched, the same days that Fulmer did. So there is a plan 1A, and it is Santiago. He will back up Fulmer, and you know, if he hasn't pitched in other games before Fulmer's start, you know, he'll be the backup on days if he does, you know, fall down. But Fulmer pitched very well the last couple. They feel that the decision is the right one to start him in the major leagues. But if there's a major concern starting the season and someone you're going to watch, it certainly is Fulmer.
Given the way that Hap has played in training camp and, as you say, you know, winning a job and all the rest of it, what – I know he's not locked into one position, but how will they try to keep him on the field? Do you expect him to play second base? Do you expect him to play, I guess he starts as the center fielder. Mm-hmm. Will he play on the corners? How do you get him? And I guess the question really is about what they did with Schwarber, you know, where he's trying to learn left field and he's also going to lead off. Is this a lot to put on this kid, having him being a multi-position player, not having kind of a home position, if you will?
I don't think it is. This is a tough kid. You know, yeah. I watched him come up early last year with not a lot of expectations other than within the organization and be a very credible major league player with no experience. That said, he had very limited time in the outfield. He was mostly a second baseman in college and in the minor leagues. He's made great strides as a outfielder in spring training and the off season. He's a guy that is not going to scare. He's not going to be upset if he fails. It's a great question though, Mike. You know, you had the big strikeout guy leading off last year in Schwarber, and it didn't work out. Hap ended last year striking out a ton as well. I think he just wore down from his first major league season. They feel that he is going to take the job and run with it. Now, again, does that mean that Almora is not going to play out there? No. He's going to play. He's a very good outfielder. But the idea that Hap can handle the job at the top of the order, I think he can. But, again, the strikeout factor is something you want to watch because it's been a part of his DNA up until now. And we know in Major League Baseball now the 150 strikeout guy is just fine. If you're not 175 or 180 – you're okay as long as your OPS is up there and you're in the 800s with the firepower that he can show from the left and the right side. You know, this guy can be a 900 OPS guy, and that's what they're looking for from him this year.
Zober said he's not very comfortable playing first base, and you know, a lot of things he's got to re-educate himself on. Is that trying to get him to back up Rizzo? Is that more about getting Rizzo rest, or trying to maybe tip your, or you know, acknowledge the fact that Zobrist is getting up there in age and has injury issues and at least won't have to move around a lot at first base?
No, I think you have to move around more there, really, Brian. You know, you might not have the length that you have to go in the other positions, like in the outfield and second base, but Zobrist told me 2 days ago that first base to him is the hardest position. Okay, because there's so much responsibility on bunt plays, on making the proper throw on the 6-3, 3-6-3. You know, something that he hasn't done a lot of. Even though he's an accomplished backup guy, he feels that there's so much responsibility there that it's going to take him a lot to make sure that he's really good at it. And this is a guy that worries about everything. I mean, he's been one of the most accomplished extra guys and super utility men in baseball for the last 15 years, and he still worries about his play every day. You know, I had a conversation with Madden about it the other day, and he says, you know, the guy just, you know, he internalizes so much, he'd like to see him relax a little more because he's so good that he doesn't have to worry about it. But, you know, that's just the makeup, and that's just the DNA of Zobrist. So I think he's going to be good over there. I think, to answer your question totally, I think they want Anthony Rizzo to have some extra days off. I think he's, if you look at the end of his seasons, except for a couple, you know, he's worn down. I think 147, 150 games would be exactly enough for him. So therefore, you know, you're probably going to have another 15 games for another first baseman.
You know, we were talking about Rizzo earlier in the show and the idea that no one voted for him in ESPN's poll of all their baseball experts. No one voted for him for MVP. Chris Bryant, third in MVP voting. Rizzo received no votes. And
Contreras got a few.
Yeah, Contreras is... And, you know, and Brian brought out that, you know, respect me moment last year when he screamed at Washington and the idea that you're putting him in a situation where he hits. Is he not respected outside Chicago? Is he not regarded in the same fashion as maybe the people of the Cub fans do?
You know, I think that's valid. I believe that he's an unappreciated superstar because he plays a position where there are other superstars playing. I mean, Paul Goldschmidt won the Gold Glove over Rizzo last year, and Goldschmidt is an outstanding first baseman. Rizzo is the guy that went through 123 games without making an error. Rizzo is the guy that charges the batter fearlessly so that right. They can create a situation on a bunt where they take it away. He throws as well as any first baseman in the game. I think he's tremendously underrated, and what does he do best in clutch situations? He chokes up. He hits the other way. He changes his position in the batter's box. He'll get hit by a pitch when it's necessary. To me, he is the most valuable player on the Cubs, and they have three or four other guys that are just as valuable as far as the league goes. But to me, I think he's the guts of the team.
All righty, Bruce. Thank you, buddy.
All right, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks,
that's
Bruce.
Bruce Levine, the Scores Baseball Expert. We are going to bring in Mike DeCourcy, and we'll talk to him. He's a Big Ten Network analyst. We'll ask him, how do the Ramblers beat Michigan? Can you give us the game plan? Can you break down the tape and tell us? Boy, don't get choked up, Mully. Mully and Haley on the Score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.